Hey everybody, I'm Jerry. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not sure either, you know. That's nice. All right. Is that better? No echo? No echo, 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 echo. Okay. I got to share this. This is what Joanne gave me before the meeting. It's a bald man's hairbrush. Okay. And I mentioned to her that, you know, if I wanted this kind of abuse, I really could have stayed home. And I was sharing with my lovely bride, about talking about being bald as an example. And she says, Jerry, she says, you know, you're going to have to learn some politically correct language. You're not bald. Politically, the politically correct way of saying this is that you're follically challenged. So if anybody out there is, you know, have the same follicle challenge that I do, I call her my bride. I started calling my bride after I got, you know, we've had 13 wonderful, beautiful, happy years together. We've been married 24, but we've had 13 wonderful, beautiful, and it's been like the first one and the last 12 in sobriety. The first year in sobriety was kind of touch and go, but she really is like my bride, because we had to get to know each other all over again. You know, like newlyweds do, you have to get to know each other, and she was getting to know a new person, and I was getting to know a new person when she was getting into Al-Anon, and it's been a neat journey. But one time she says, Jerry, you know, it's kind of embarrassing you haven't introduced me as your bride all the time. You know, people think we just got married. So I started calling her my first wife for a while, and she, no, that's okay, you can call me. I am an alcoholic. What does that mean? You know, last week I got pretty serious, and I did that for a reason. We have a lot of fun in this program, and Bill Wilson talks about that. He says, you know, if people come in from the outside and they see all this levity and everything, they wonder, you know, what's really going on here? But underlying that is a deadly seriousness, and it is a deadly seriousness. And when I say I'm an alcoholic, to me it means a lot more than I'm powerless over alcohol, or that I drink too much, or that I do things that are kind of crazy, you know, when I drink. When I say I'm an alcoholic, I'm talking about alcohol controlled my life, and it controlled my reactions to life. And the way I like to put it is, when I drink, I do things I didn't mean to do. I say things I didn't mean to say. I hurt the people that I love the most. I get consequences that I don't mean to get. And I become something that I don't want to be, okay? And last week, that was kind of an example of what I had become in my alcoholism, something I did not want to be. And I'll mention this, you know, it just absolutely amazes me. I get overwhelmed with gratefulness once in a while. It amazes me that people ask me to do the steps, because I had such a hard time doing them. And maybe it's why I'm asked to do the steps, because I had to really struggle with those things. It also amazes me, one other thing amazes me, is that people that know me today that did not know me when I was drinking have a hard time believing that I had a reputation as a hair-triggered, violent-tempered, angry drunk. But that's the reality of the way things were at the end. And I didn't start off that way. In fact, I started off quite a bit differently. Well, so maybe some of this comes from my family background. My dad was tough. You know, he was in World War II. He was a reconnaissance platoon leader. He'd go out and try to find the enemy. And after the war, he was in what they called the GI Olympics in Czechoslovakia, in pistol shooting and in boxing. All right. So when I was growing up, he was tough, and he wanted me to be tough, and I wanted to be tough. The only problem is I had this back problem. See, yellow streak about that wide, you know. and he tried to teach me how to box. I remember one time when in grade school, I guess it was maybe third grade, I came tearing in the house, crying, just absolutely terrified. I was running away from bullies and that lived in the neighborhood. And he sent me back outside, and he told me that I either go out there and face them, or I'd have to face him when I came inside. And I went outside. I'd rather face the bullies than face him. And later we moved out into the country and had a woodshed, and it was not for storing wood. And what he was trying to do, and I recognize this today, because I have some younger brothers, and he was a lot easier on them than he was on me. And I guess he was trying to prepare me for life. And he tried to teach me how to box, you know. And what that meant was I got to be a real good beating taker. You know, I learned to be a real good beating taker. And it came in handy later on, you know. I mean, later on in years, I could take a beating better than anybody. And usually what I would try to do is get a little inebriated first so I wouldn't feel it. You know, at least I was anesthetized before the beating took place. And about the only time I would get into scraps is when I was drunk. I hardly ever get into scraps when I was sober. But that's, you know, alcohol did some things for me that I couldn't do for myself. I was kind of like the before after picture, you know. Have you seen the Hefty Bag commercials?
Wimpy, wimpy, wimpy.
You know, and drink a little beer, you know, drink a little booze, and hefty, 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 you know. A total personality change, right? So that's how I got to be a beating taker. But I didn't start off being what I eventually became towards the end of my alcoholism. In fact, I started off doing something quite different. I went away to a Franciscan monastery at the ripe old age of 12 years old to study to become a Franciscan monk. I was a monk's apprentice. I guess I was a mini monk for a while, you know.
Birth, the blend, the blend.
You know, and if I'd have stayed in long enough, I'd have probably been the drunk monk. You know, can you imagine me as a monk? Good Lord. That would have been a total disaster. But anyway, I was asked to leave the seminary after partaking of the altar wine before I became a priest, and end up doing some things, you know, types of things we all did later on when I was drinking. I made a fool out of myself. I urinated on a radiator, steam heated radiator, in the wintertime in a boy's dormitory and raised the stink in more ways than one. And they told me they didn't think I was monk material, you know. So then I left the seminary, and then I went back to this thing of I got to be tough, and I wanted to be popular, I want to be all these things, and then none of that. You know, I mean, I was just a basket case. I was like 16-year-old kids, you know, weighed all of maybe 98 pounds, and 12 pounds of that was pimples, you know, and I wanted to be tough. And then I discovered, and I couldn't talk to girls. I remember, because I had hardly ever even talked. They didn't have girls in a Catholic seminary for some reason, you know. So I had never talked to girls or dated or danced or anything. I didn't know how to dance or anything. And if I tried to talk to a girl, I was called the chameleon kid in high school, because I just, you know, I just blush and turn colors and just stupid things that come out of my mouth and just sweaty palms. Just get totally embarrassed. Until we had a pizza and beer party, and what happened is I found out that after one or two or three or four or more beers, that you know, I didn't blush, and my tongue didn't cleave to the roof of my mouth, you know, and I didn't break out in these cold sweats, and I didn't say stupid things. Excuse me, I still slip into slur my first language once in a while. I didn't say. That's what you were going to do. You were going to say AA has no foos or D's, right? Or D's are foos or something like that. Yeah, I do that all the time. That's true. Anyway. And I found out that after two or three or four more beers that I thought I was witty and eloquent. And so alcohol began to do some things for me in the beginning that I could not do for myself. I thought it changed my personality. I used to tell people, alcohol helps me to, you know, release my personality. And they would say things like, Jerry, your personality wasn't released, it escaped. You know, nobody can put it back, you know. And in a way, that's true. And in the beginning, alcohol did do some things for me that I couldn't do for myself. But as time went on, my response to life was controlled by my alcohol. And it got to be later on, especially in the last couple of years of my drinking, the way I lived. I mean, if you drank the way I drank, and drank in the places that I drank and how I drank. I mean, for a long time, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought I was a hemophiliac. You know, I was going to bleed to death. Because I would keep getting, hefty, 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 you know, and getting into scraps and being a good beating taker, I would bleed a lot. And I drank down. I didn't want anybody to know in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I had a good job, how much I drank. So I would gravitate to bars where people I knew didn't go. And I would go to biker bars on the north end of Charlotte in a three-piece vested business suit and tie, okay? And then wonder why my teeth hurt. And I can remember one time sitting next to this biker, and he had rings on his fingers. And I made some wisecrack to him about, aren't you tough with all those rings? And I found out why they wore the rings. Because what the rings did is they had these little points that came out, you know? And when they hit you, you bleed. And I still got a couple dents over here. And I can remember, you know, he kind of backhanded me off the bar, and I got back. I was laying there, and I'm thinking, now do I lay here? Do I get up and leave? Or do I get up and then make another wisecrack to this guy? And I crawled back up there, and I thought, well, maybe I can disarm him with humor. Yeah. I said, you know, I'd offer to buy you a drink, but you know, you get nasty when you drink. And next thing I know, there we are. He's on, you know, I'm on the floor and they're wiping up the floor with me and that type of thing. And then I would go back. That's the place I went back to with these Japanese businessmen, you know. I had some Japanese businessmen that were visiting and I took them back to the biker bar because I thought they were samurai alcoholics, oh, you know, that they knew karate or something. They were all about 50 years old and fat and bald like me, you know, and we ended up getting chased out of that place. But when you live that way, what happens after a while is I got to a point where I knew sooner or later somebody was going to attack me verbally, emotionally, physically. And it got to a point in my life where I wouldn't wait for that. That if you even looked cross-eyed at me, or if you looked like you were maybe thinking about, you know, doing me some harm, emotionally, physically, verbally, anyway, I'd counterattack first. And that's where that reputation about that anger came from. And so towards the end of my drinking, I was known as a hair-trigger drunk. I mean, they say, yeah. I mean, he'll go off on you for little or no reason at all. You just, I mean, you can't be around him. And that was the truth. I would go off for little or no reason at all. And I had all these real or imagined attacks come at me. And my response, my response to the external world was like the external world was out to get me, to attack me all the time. And so my response to life became a vicious, lifelong counterattack, especially towards the end of my drinking. And that's why I say I had this reputation for just being just mean, you know, just hair trigger temper and all that. And people that know me today kind of look and say, no. But then the people that knew me back in Charlotte, and I'll share a little bit of that with you when we talk about step nine, they didn't believe I am, you know, that I've changed the way I have today either. You know, they still expected the old Jerry to come back in there. You know, there's, not only was I powerless over alcohol, but I was powerless over my alcohol control, my total response to life. And what I was doing is I was responding to the external world with all this anger and all this resentment and all this fear. And really it was fear that just translated into anger. And as an alcoholic, and I don't think this is this unusual, my whole life was externally controlled by what I thought you were going to do, or by what I thought you were going to say, or by what I thought what you were going to do, effect you were going to have on me. And that's why I was on a constant defensive and offensive. My response to life was controlled by you, by the external world, by what I thought you were going to do to me. All right. And now in recovery, what happens is our response, it's not even a response. We begin to be controlled more by internal principles. Internal ethics. They're called spiritual principles. And as we get down to step nine, that's one of the spiritual principles we're talking about. One of the spiritual principles we talk about is justice. And it's honesty. And it's being real about what's happened and making amends where possible. And that's what we'll talk about in step nine a little bit tonight. Fairness. You know, and all these are spiritual principles. In step eight, it says we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And I emphasize that the willingness, if we don't have it, we pray for the willingness. And that's an important part of that step. And I'll be honest with you, when I really looked at step four and five, and some of the things I shared with you about Jerry last week, it should have been very hard for me not to be forgiving of other people if I looked at myself honestly. Okay, because really, when I compared the things that I had done and the way I was with the real or imagined harm done to me, it was nothing in comparison. It should have been easy for me to forgive other people compared to some of the things that I had done and some of the things that I wanted forgiveness for. It was not as easy as it should have been. I still had a tough time with it. But they say make the list. And we don't not only make the list from our four-step list, but we go back over our entire lives. And I think I shared with you that a lot of these character traits were there long before I became, quote-unquote, became the alcoholic. I think really what happened is I was an alcoholic waiting to pick up the first drink. I had all the character traits long before the first drink entered the picture. And all the first drink did, and the subsequent drinks did, is those basic character defects that were already there just get magnified. When I drink, they come out sideways. I mean, they really come out weird. And that's kind of what happened over the years. and the more they came out sideways, the more people responded negatively to me, and the more defensive and angry I got in my response to the world. Okay? So when we step eight, we begin to make a list of all these people we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And that's tough, because I had a lot of people that I thought had harmed me. All right? In step nine, we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And every once in a while, I hear in meetings, and I think I mentioned this last week, and I heartily disagree with this. I'm very opinionated about this one thing. I hear every once in a while, well, you really shouldn't make amends in this situation because it might harm you, and you're one of the others. I've heard that in meetings, and I'll tell you what, that's not what it says in the big book. It gives some very different examples. It says we should be willing to go to any lengths to make amends wherever possible, unless it does harm somebody else or harm the person we're making the amends to. And as we begin to make this list, it divides the amends into different categories. So some of the people you need to make amends to right away. All right. In fact, when I look back on it, my sponsor had me beginning to make amends as soon as I got into the program. There were a couple of situations that really could not wait. Okay. One of them was Mr. Bedell. Okay. Mr. Bedell was the owner of the Expressway Inn, the motel room that I burned down when I shot the flare gun inside the place. Okay. And my agreement for being allowed to get out of this room with no doorknobs was that I was going to pay for the damages. So that's not an amends that could really wait. And one of the first things I did was get a job and make an agreement. And you know, I was in fear of what this guy could do to me. And he really could have done a lot of damage. I mean, they could have put me away for a long time. You know, they have things like called arson and so forth. And assault with a deadly weapon, you know, and firing a flare gun at cars going down Beach Boulevard. And that's a typical response. You know, I was responding to what I thought the external world was attacking me. As I was trying to walk across Beach Boulevard in the middle of the night with an arm full of booze, you know, I thought these cars were trying to run me down on purpose. You know, I was just a guy out there in a dark clothing and couldn't judge how far away these lights were, and was, you know, kind of stepping out in front of them and hearing, you know, and people stopping and waving without all their fingers. So I had shot some flares at cars on Beach Boulevard, you know, hid in between the bread trucks and the Marita Bread Place and waited for them in the middle of the night. Got you some bitch, you know, and bright red flares go bouncing off this guy's windshield. What the hell is that? You know, some pothead out there, you know, wow, man, UFOs, far out, you know. But anyway, my last flare was in the motel room, and I caught the place on fire. And so the police had been called a couple times. They were waiting outside, and they took me to this room with no doorknobs on the inside. And when I got out, I had to make amends to Mr. Bedell. And you know, that guy was so, I mean, he was so nice. Now, he didn't have to be that way. And here I was afraid of him. I mean, I was absolutely terrified of this guy. I wanted to just kind of leave the city and leave the state, you know, and do the old geographic cure routine, and they'll never find me. But I knew I couldn't do that. Ed confronted me right up front, you know, you got to do what's right. And I'll mention this a couple times. He says, you got to do what's right because it's the right thing to do. For no other reason than because it's the right thing to do. So I had to start making amends to this guy, financial amends right away. And he allowed me to go back and live there. Can you imagine this? After I got out, he allowed me to go back and live there. So I was able to do some of the repair work myself and save a little money because I got the same room back. But anyway. Yeah. Harvey says, what do you got on the back of your shirt? And I thought it was paint, but I'm kind of wondering if it's the same shirt I wore when I was repairing the motel room. But anyway, one of the other amends I made is my wife, we had lost our home in North Carolina, and my wife had booted me out, and it was 6 months. We were separated for 6 months when I got sober, when I came into AA. I don't know if I was really sober. I was dry in the beginning. I think sobriety is something that takes a while. And Ed told me, almost immediately, he says, your first job is to get a job, and your second job is to start sending some money up to the wife and kids. Now, I'll tell you, Ed was a very directive sponsor for me in the beginning. My current sponsor is not that directive. But in the beginning, I'll be honest with you, I needed a directive sponsor. Okay? Because if I was left up to my own thinking, I'd still be in deep trouble. But he says, your first job is to get a job, and your next job is you need to start sending some money up to the wife and five kids. Well, I didn't think we were ever going to get back together. And you know what my response to that was? This is how sick I was. Why? They're never coming back. Because she told me so when she told me to leave and was waving without all their fingers goodbye, you know. And Ed looked at me and he said, because it's the right thing to do, Jerry. And if you're going to get sober and stay sober in this program, you're going to do things for no other reason than because it's the right thing to do. And he was instilling in me very, very soon, don't go looking at the world and don't go looking at other people in terms of doing it for what I can get out of it. Do it based on internal spiritual principles, and the rest of it will work out. Okay? And that was from the very beginning, from the very get-go, it was being instilled in me that I was operating on spiritual principles. Well, you know, my poor wife, you know, she gets this check. She hadn't heard from me about 6 months. She gets this check, and she looks at it, you know, and she's saying, right. You know, she puts it in the bank and deposits it and decides to wait for 10 days before she dares write a check against it. And while she's waiting for the first one, she gets a second one. And the first one clears. And while she's waiting for the second one to clear, she gets a third one. And every week after that, she was getting checks for 2 months. And after 2 months, she says, there's something different. You know, I mean, this is a guy that couldn't support us when he lived here. And now he's sending us checks and they're not bouncing. There's something different. And what happened was, when I began to operate on internal principles, guess what happened? The external response to me changed. She called me up and she says, Jerry, I must be nuts, but let's try it again. So she came back down and she joined us, and we lived in the Expressway Inn in that little motel room for a couple of days until I could find a place. We really did. Oh, that was a zoo. What happened to the walls? Oh, I don't know. I think they painted them black on purpose, you know. Keep it cooler in here. Oh, Lord. Why are you painting the walls, Jerry? One of the other men's, there's also, it talks about amends that cannot ever be made totally. And there's some different reasons for this. Some of the amends we can't make because it would harm the person that we're supposed to make the amends to. Obviously, I don't tell my wife all of the nitty-gritty details of my activities when I was drinking because it would harm her. I mean, I think she knows in a general way that some of this stuff went on, but she doesn't have to know all this garbage. So the way I make amends to her now is I act like a husband. What a change. Okay? What a change. So now she doesn't worry about it. I mean, she's not on the phone tonight calling all over the place and wondering where I'm at. And, you know, my alcoholism, it really affected her in a lot of ways. One instance will give you some idea. I came home one night. I had been out drinking before I graduated to the biker bars, I went to pool halls, you know. That was drinking my way down. I went from, you know, these nice lounges, and then I went to pool halls, and then eventually ended up at biker bars. And I ended up at this pool hall, and it was Spanky's Lounge, and they had a pit where they had the pool tables, and I kept backing the bar stool up, joking around, clowning them like I do, and I backed two legs, went down into the pit, and the bar stool went backwards, and I cracked my head on the back of a pool table. Well, I was in the blackout. I didn't know it, so I drove home, you know. And it was in the summertime in Charlotte, and it was about 3 a.m., and Ann was asleep. I didn't want to wake her up, you know, so I turned the lights off and coast into the driveway and close the door real quiet, sneak upstairs and lay down on top of the sheets. Well, I had bled all the way down the back of my shirt and the back of my head, and the blood dried, see, okay? So when I woke up in the morning, you know, with the light coming in, you know, and I started getting shaky and wake up early, I sat up in bed. Well, the sheets came with me. They were kind of stuck to the back of my head, you know? So my poor bride, she wakes up to the feeling of these sheets come, you know, being pulled off her, and she sees this ghostly specter rising in the morning light, you know? So what does she do? You know, she reaches over, turns on the light, and goes, you know, rips off the sheets. Well, that just starts it bleeding all over again. So all of a sudden, the light goes on, and I hear this screaming behind me, right? I don't even know I had bled, you know? And I turn around, what's wrong with you, you know? And she says, you're bleeding. And I said, well, why are you screaming? I'm the one that's bleeding, you know? And she asked me what happened. I had no earthly idea what happened. I had to go back to the bar that day, and they asked me if I was okay. And I got my head all bandaged up. Yeah, why do you ask? They told me what happened. Then as a joke, they kind of put training wheels on my bar stool, you know. But, you know, she had to live this way. She lived this way for 11 years. Day in and day out, never knowing what's going to happen next. And when I didn't show up, when I was supposed to show up, wondering what in the world happened to me. And I would come home bleeding sometimes. I'd come home with a car wreck sometimes. Sometimes I wouldn't come home. I mean, she just never knew from one minute to the next what was going to happen. And that takes a toll on people, okay? And what happened with her is she began to react like her life was being controlled externally by me. She was not free to act spontaneously anymore. All she could do was react to what was going on with Jerry, you know? God, is he in trouble this time? What do I got to do over here? And is he going to get up and go to work? Is he going to lose his job? And all this kind of garbage for 11 years. Now, she didn't unlearn that overnight either. But see, making amends is trying to get some stability and some acting like a husband, and also maybe acting like a responsible person. Every once in a while after a meeting, I'll go with somebody and we'll end up talking for several hours, okay? I don't just disappear. I mean, even though she's probably knows I'm probably okay, I'll still give her a call and say, honey, I'm with one of the guys, you know, and we're sitting down, we're having a piece of pie and a cup of coffee, and we're going to talk for a while. So she knows, and begin to react responsibly. My kids, again, they weren't free to act spontaneously. All they could do, you know, most kids, when dad comes in the house when they're little kids, you know, daddy, they're free to spontaneously run up to him, grab his leg, yeah, give me a horseback ride, all right? My kid's response to me coming home was, what's he like today? Is it okay to go up and grab his leg and hug him? I mean, is he a happy drunk or is he a mad drunk today? And they weren't free to act spontaneously. All they could do was react to how I was. And you know, kids learn this at a young age and they don't unlearn it real quickly. When I got into sobriety a little ways, I loved to take my kids to the beach. I mean, I love to take them to the beach because I wasn't controlling anything. There was nothing that they could do wrong. I mean, what are you going to tell them? Don't mess up the waves, you know? Don't mess up the sand, you know? No. I mean, they can be free and they can have fun and they can run around. They can't get into too much trouble unless they swim out too far. And I found a cure for that. Before we took them to the beach, I'd rent Jaws and let them see it three times, you know? Ooh, I'm not going to the water, you know? You know, so I didn't have to worry about controlling them, you know, any of that stuff. But I loved to do that. I loved to take them to the beach because they could be free. You know, they couldn't get into trouble. There wasn't a whole lot they could do wrong when they were young. And it gave them an opportunity for them to enjoy themselves and for me to enjoy them and be with them, okay? In a different kind of environment. So they could learn, hopefully, to be more spontaneous to life. And I think they are a lot more today. The oldest two boys are probably the ones that suffered the most. The oldest one definitely suffered the most from my alcoholism. Younger three kids, they don't even remember it. I mean, there were 4, 2, and 1 when I got sober. My daughter remembers a little bit, but the two youngest ones hardly remember anything at all. I mean, they don't know their dad drunk. They've heard about some things, and that's neat. I mean, it's neat to have, you know, some of them that have never had to live through all that garbage that the older ones had to live through. And I don't know that we can ever undo some of the damage. Okay, but we do the best we can. And again, how do you make amends? Maybe I start acting like a father, because it's awfully tough to explain to an 8-year-old kid and to a 9-year-old kid why dad was the way he was for so years in a way that they would understand. So maybe I start acting like a father, you know, and allowing them to be themselves and not having to have control over them all the time. You know what? A neat thing is, if I do the right things, I have influence. That's different than control. I have influence. And influence is something that people willingly give you because you have something that they want. And that is much more effective than control. Control is trying to make somebody do what you want them to do. Influence is maybe being more of an example and then seeing what you have and then maybe they want it. There were some other amends I had to make too. You know, I lived in a lot of fear. There was partial amends. Again, Anne was partial amends. I could make some partial amends to her. Some parts I couldn't make. There are people that I could never reach. I have no idea where these three fat, middle-aged Japanese businessmen are today. You know, they're probably in Tokyo someplace. I can only remember one of their names. They're on my list. I'm willing to make amends to them, but I have no idea how to reach them, okay? There are people on that list that I've never been in touch with and that I don't know that I'll ever be able to contact. there are people on that list that I met coincidentally years and years later when I was ready. And that was neat. There was a guy on the list who used to work for me at this corporation that I worked with for 11 years. And when I got demoted, he got my job. And I sabotaged that guy every chance I got because I thought, how dare he? You know, I thought he had backstabbed me and butt-kissed his way into my job, so I was out to get him. And he was my boss. He ended up being my boss. And why he put up with me for as long as he did, I have no earthly idea. And finally, he was the man that had to fire me. I mean, after I took the Japanese businessman to this bar and we had an accident on the way back and two of them ended up in a hospital, and I went back into the office the next day like nothing's wrong here. You know, he says, where were you? I mean, you went to lunch with the Japanese and you disappeared, and where are the Japanese? And I had to tell him, well, one's been treated and released and the other one's at this hospital and he's in stable condition. And he had to say, well, Jerry, you know, we love you, man, but we can't keep you on. We gotta let you go. And I was so angry. I was so angry when he let me go that I left. And I left in such a hurry, I think I made some threatening, all kinds of weird stuff. I mean, I drank on them for a long time, and let me put it that way, to let you know. So I owed them money, and I was here in Florida, and they were in North Carolina, and I had no idea whether they had warrants out on me, you know, whether they were after me for this or for that, whether they knew where I was, but they were on my list, and I was terrified of this man. I was absolutely terrified of this man. But Ed said, you need to make financial amends and you need to make personal amends. And I did not have the money to make the financial amends. And so for 2 years I worked and I put a little bit aside and put a little bit aside because I thought I knew about how much it was. I was kind of guessing. I had no earthly idea. And then one day after 2 years of sobriety, I got an assignment to go to Charlotte, North Carolina on a job. I said, okay, it's time. And I had to do it. I knew I had to do it. And I went up there, and one of the first things I did was call their office in Matthews on Monday morning and said, Ron, this is Jerry Webster. And it was this long pause. I said, I need to see you. Well, really kind of busy, you know. I'm going to be in town all week. I said, I just need to come by and talk. Well, what about? I said, well, I really don't want to discuss it on the phone. I need to see you personally. So he finally gave in and made this appointment. And then I went to see him, right? And I go in, and the secretary is out in his outer office, and he's in the inner office, and he tells the secretary, leave the door open. Okay? I mean, he probably thought, this madman is coming. I mean, he threatened to do me harm. He's coming here to do it, you know? He's kind of looking me over real close, you know, any lumps in his pockets, you know, and bombs, guns, you know, flare guns, I don't know, you know, any of that stuff. So I sat down and I started talking to him. And see, what I thought when I left there was that he had cheated me out of my job and he had backstabbed me and he'd done me all these terrible deeds and so forth. And that was my justification for taking these credit cards. Well, I deserve it after all those. You know, they owe me, you know. And when I got sober, I began to look at the reality of the situation. And I had to tell Ron, I says, you know, the reality of the situation, Ron, I owe you an amends. I says, I know I did you harm, and I talked to all these people about you and backstabbed you and all this stuff. And I said, and I was, my problem was that I'm an alcoholic, and I was really into my cups, and I really had a distorted view. And I said, I recognize today that all that happened is I had a good job, and I was screwing it up. And you were a very capable person that happened to be available. And I said, and I recognize the truth of it today, and I need to make amends. And he just said, Jerry, he closed the door. You know, I'm just so glad to see you sober and got your life back together. And then I told him I needed to go around and make the amends to the people that I had backstabbed him to. And he says, Jerry, you don't have to do that for me. I said, I know it, Ron. I need to do it for me. I'm not doing it. I need to do it for me. And I had to go around that office and find some of the people, the ones that I remembered, the ones that were still there that I had kind of backstabbed this guy to and set the record straight. And they knew. I mean, they knew. And they were just glad to see me sober. And I said, I got one other thing I need to do. And I told him about the money. He says, well, I don't, you know, I was going to give him the money. He says, I don't know what to do with it. He says, let's go see the accountant. Let's go see the accountant. So we went down to see the guy who was in charge of finances, the financial officer of the corporation, and he looked at me and he says, well, Jerry, we wrote that off years ago as a bad debt. We don't know what to do with the money if you gave it to us. And so we discussed it, and they didn't want to take it. And I said, I've got to make this amend somehow. You know, we need to find some way of doing this. So finally, they took the money, and they put it into a Christmas party fund for the employees. And that was the way we worked it out. But you know what? Ron and I ended up being the best of friends. Because guess what? He was getting ready to move to Japan, where I had lived for 6 months. And he had no idea where the schools were, you know, where a good place to live was. And I ended up talking to him and helping him out, putting him in touch with some people up there that had helped us find housing and schools and all that kind of thing. And we ended up being the best of friends. And I would have never found out what a neat, wonderful guy he was had I not made that amends. I had some other amends to do. It says, we do not dodge our creditors. Okay. When I got sober, I was approximately $40,000 in debt. Several thousand for the credit cards. Lots of unpaid bills, a mortgage. I mean, the house was repossessed, and it was just a total disaster. There were medical bills, there were all kinds of things. And I didn't know what to do. I mean, I had skipped town, and I didn't know what to do. And I just made a list of everybody, and I wrote to them all. And I said, what I did is I added up the total amount that I owed, and I added up the total amount that I made, and I deducted all the expenses, and I had a certain amount left over, and I said, okay, this percentage is your percentage of what I owe everybody. I can send you this much. I said, and if you want to, I mean, you can take me into bankruptcy and everything, but I don't have anything. I didn't own a house. We had a 13-year-old dryer. We had a 13-year-old washer. I had a Dempsey dumpster mobile. It's an automobile, my 1979 Chevette. I mean, and holes in the floorboards, you know, air conditioning, you know, you get the car washed from the inside out. But all that kind of stuff. And you know what? Every single one of those people agreed to work with me on that schedule except one. And the one that wouldn't work with me was a laboratory that we owed $68 to. It was the only one that wouldn't work with us. I mean, we owed Sears thousands of dollars. We had all this money on the mortgage, all this other thing. It took approximately 9 years, 8 or 9 years to pay off all those debts, and they're all paid off today. And you know, I was walking around in fear. It says the promises in step 9 will be freedom from fear of financial insecurity and people. And see, part of that freedom comes from facing our fears and dealing with the wreckage of the past. I tell you, I've enjoyed sobriety so much. It's not been easy, but it has been a wonderful, wonderful journey. There were some other things that, they're all different kinds of amends, all different kinds of amends. And what I suggest very strongly is that you seek guidance from your sponsor in terms of making these amends, okay? And doing your 8-step list and then addressing these people, because you can get into trouble. I mean, you can lead with a chin, and there is a possibility that you could do some harm if you don't seek some guidance on this. And there are still people on my list that I've not made amends to yet, mainly because I don't know where they are. Okay, there are a few people on my list that I've not made amends to yet because it would do some harm. But I become willing. It's just that it's not appropriate, and I can't save my own butt at their expense. That's not justified. AA works. The steps work. We're getting to the end of the action steps here. I'll mention something to you that I believe this. I believe this very, very strongly. See, my problem was my total response to life had become totally warped. I had become something that I did not want to be. And I could not just put the plug in the jug and say, okay, that's it, everything will be fine now. I had a lot of things to undo, and I had a lot of changing to make. If all I did was put the plug in the jug, I was still the same person, you know. And I see this a lot. Sometimes people put the plug in the jug and they suffer from alcoholism. You know, I was an alcoholic, now I quit drinking, everything's fine, you know. Yeah, that type of thing. I suffer from alcoholism. I put the plug in the jug. Maybe the alcohol is gone, but the ism's still there. And I've got to address all this underlying stuff, including this learned response to life that I've got to undo. And I tell you what, I think it is literally impossible, literally impossible, to stay the same way and work these steps at the same time. Because you cannot do one thing and be something else. It's impossible. You cannot do one thing and be something else. The nature of my alcoholism is selfishness, self-centeredness in the extreme. In the extreme, okay? Try to stay selfish and self-centered and get a call from a guy on Mayport Road and he doesn't know where he's at and he needs some help. In the middle of the night, at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you live in Mandarin, and drive out there until you find him, and then try to get him into Jesse Street and they don't take him, and wait until the service center opens up at 5 a.m. until you can get him in there, and then drive home just in time to take a shower and go to work. Try to do that and be selfish at the same time. You can't do it. You cannot do it. You cannot be honest in this program and face myself and be honest about what is going on with me and stay dishonest. The nature of my alcoholism is dishonesty. I mean, if my lips were moving, I was lying, okay? I cannot do that and work these steps in 4 and 5 and get honest with me and get honest with somebody else, and in an 8 and 9 and get honest with other people and stay dishonest at the same time. You cannot do one thing and be something else, okay? I cannot continue to act in a selfish way, in an unloving way, and make amends to people and try to set the record straight for the damage done, okay? You can't do one thing and be something else. And as you continue to do the things that these steps teach, and see what this is, this step 9 is not the end of the action steps. I may have said that at one point in time. It is not the end of the action steps. It's the beginning of the living steps. What we've done is we've cleaned house one time. What happens from here on out is I begin to address some of these ongoing issues. And step 10, which I'll which I'll talk about next week, keeps kicking my butt back into step 6 and 7. Because I keep having to readdress, would you be serious? This is an AA meeting for kind of, I can't take you anywhere. A hairbrush, Joanne, is used more for, you know. But it keeps kicking my butt back into step 6 and 7, which is the same basic character defects that I've always had, that I still have to deal with. I love this program. I love this program. And like I say, it's just amazing to me that people that know me today say, I can't believe that you were mean-tempered, that you were hair-trigger-tempered. I mean, that's a wonderful documentary or whatever you call it for the program, for that kind of a change. I mean, that was impossible. And people who knew me back then, I mean, Ron Eagle was a good example. He fully expected that I was going to go in there armed to the teeth with hand grenades, flare guns, and pistols and just blow the place away, you know. Oh, it's going to be another post office scene, you know, that type of thing. I mean, he fully believed that I was still the same way when I left. Leave the door open. Yeah. Be ready to dial 911, you know, that type of thing. Clear the building, you know, that type of thing. But my response to life is changing. Life's response to me is changing. Yeah. When I walk in the door tonight, my kids will still be up. I can guarantee you they're going to walk up, they're going to give me a kiss, they're going to give me a hug. They're going to ask me what's happened today. I'm going to talk to them about what's happened today. We'll talk about our plans for Easter. We'll talk about my second oldest son coming home from Gainesville tomorrow, you know, what we're going to do and spend time with him. I'll kiss my bride and she won't smell my breath. Okay, and she won't wonder where the hell I've been because she knows. And I'm just so grateful for this wonderful program and the wonderful people in it that have taught me how to live one day at a time. Okay, and I can't end with anything better than that. I love you. Talk to you next week.